When Elijah burst onto the scene about 3,000 years ago in the nation of Israel, things were about as bleak as they could possibly be. Probably the worst king of any of the kings of the Jews, maybe, King Ahab. He was Jewish, but he was married to a Phoenician who was a Baal worshiper. And through Ahab and Jezebel, the government established Baal worship. And not only did they establish Baal worship, but they tried to eliminate the worship of the true God. There were 100 prophets left in the country, but they had been hidden in caves. They were in hiding. They were not preaching. They were not out teaching. They were not out influencing the nation. They were hiding in caves. The government was working against them, against the people of God, against the religion of God. It was as black and as sad and tragic. There was immorality and every kind of unfaithfulness. And yet when Elijah comes onto the scene, Elijah is able to win victory after victory after victory. Elijah is first mentioned in 1 Kings chapter 17. And he comes on the scene and God says, through you, I'm going to bring on the land a 3-year drought. For 3 years, there will be no rain, and the people are going to starve. There's going to be famine. There will be nothing to eat. I'm trying to get their attention, and I'm going to do that. I'm going to perform this weather miracle, this devastating national calamity. I'm going to perform it through Elijah. And Elijah did that. Well, Elijah might have been thinking, wait a minute now. If I'm going to bring a 3-year drought, there's going to be famine, nothing. What am I going to do? And so God sends Elijah to Zarephath, which is outside the land, and he sends him to a widow. The widow was starving to death, and Elijah was able to provide her and her family food miraculously, and then Elijah was able to eat of that food. And so God is miraculously sustaining Elijah, who's miraculously sustaining the widow, while this 3-year drought that was brought on by Elijah's word happens. The son of the woman dies, and Elijah performs what is to me the most unbelievable of all miracles, except for the creation, and that is a resurrection. It doesn't get any bigger, more powerful than a resurrection, right? When somebody's dead, I mean good and dead, I don't mean they just passed out, I don't mean they've been out for a little bit, and maybe they're dead, and there's still maybe a little thready heartbeat or something, but the person's good and dead, and God brings them back. That's a miracle. And Elijah was able to do that. And then, of course, there's this big contest on Mount Carmel where Elijah says, get all the prophets of Baal, and I'm going to come up there, and we're going to have a contest. We're going to have this big showdown between God and the God and Baal and the prophets of Baal. And so you know what happens. They make that altar, and the prophets of Baal are jumping around and hollering and cutting themselves and acting like fools, trying to get Baal's attention, while Elijah just mocks them. Well, maybe he's asleep. Maybe he's taking a nap. Maybe he's gone on a trip. Maybe he's in the restroom. Maybe he just doesn't hear you. So keep going. And they do, and they make fools of themselves, and nothing happens. And then when Elijah prays to God, God sends the fire on that altar. Remember that had been soaked with water over and over and over and over. And the whole thing is consumed. And Elijah says, now, how do you like me now? What do you think about that? Then he says, get those prophets. He says to the people who were there watching, get those prophets. And Elijah is about to go on a tenacious run. Elijah's feeling it now. He says, man, I brought on a drought. I raised somebody from the dead. I made food. I brought this fire from heaven. Now we're going to take over. And so he tells the people, grab those false prophets and slay them. And they did. They got them. They killed all those people. And so Elijah then actually walks up to King Ahab, who had killed prophets of God. And Elijah walks up to King Ahab and has a confrontation, a showdown with King Ahab. And he says, you better get home because I'm about to bring an end to this 3-year drought. It's going to storm and rain, and we're going to have a lot of rain. And so Ahab gets in his chariot and he heads back, probably a 30-mile trip, to Jezreel, which was probably the center of his military complex. And he's going back to Jezreel. And the Bible says that Elijah sprinted to Jezreel about a 30-mile trip and outran Ahab to Jezreel. He got there before Ahab did, and Ahab was driving. And Elijah got there before him. That's longer than a marathon. And he sprints and beats him there. Boy, Elijah is just, this guy's feeling it. He's done all of these miracles. He's had all of this success. He's had a standoff with the king. And now he's not going to Samaria. Elijah doesn't run to Samaria. That was the capital. Elijah runs to Jezreel, which was probably the center of the military complex of Ahab. What is he going to do there? Why would he do that? Because Elijah is so confident. He's so brave. He's feeling this so much. He says, I'm going to go right into Camp Lejeune. I'm going to get right into Fort Bragg. I'm going to walk right in there where all the soldiers and chariots and horses and swords and all that stuff is, and I'm going to take them on, and we're going to run them out, and we're going to straighten this whole thing out. And so that's where he is. He's at Jezreel. And so notice in 1 Kings chapter 19, when Elijah gets to Jezreel, look what happens. All of a sudden, his attitude changes. All of a sudden, he goes from really, really brave to really terrified. Look what happens in 1 Kings 19 and verse 1. Ahab told Jezebel, that Ahab was a knucklehead, wasn't he? Isn't that crazy? Everything that goes wrong with Ahab, what does he do? He tells on people to his wife. Ahab was the king. Ahab could have done anything he wanted, but every time something goes wrong, he goes to his wife and says, they won't let me do this, or I can't have that, or this is going on, and I'm not getting my way. And she says, man, just go play with your toys. Let me handle this. I'll take care of this. So Ahab tells Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, so may the gods do to me and even more if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. Basically, what does she say? You're a dead man. I'm going to kill you. I mean, you killed my prophets, I'm going to kill you. And if I don't kill you, I hope the gods kill me and do even worse. Which, by the way, is exactly what's going to happen to her, but that's later on. And so she says, I'm going to kill you. So here's Elijah. He's performed all these miracles, super brave, faces down the prophets of Baal, runs to the military complex of Ahab, ready to take on the whole nation. And Jezebel says, I'm going to kill you. And then look at verse 3. And he was afraid. That quick. It just, bam, he's up there, he's rocking and rolling and everything's great and he's going and all of a sudden, way, his legs are out from under him. He's afraid. And look what he does. He was afraid and he arose and ran for his life. So he just sprinted to Fort Bragg to take on the whole military. And now what's he doing? Running for his life. He ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there, but he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree and requested for himself what? What is his request? Elijah went from confident, brave, I got it, we got it going on. We're going to take this thing over. We're going to fix everything to what? Lord, kill me now. Kill me now. Just take me out. I'm done. Elijah, because of the threat of Jezebel, responds by running. And he runs. Now listen, it was pretty impressive when he ran 30 miles from Carmel to Jezreel. Running from Jezebel, he runs 100 miles to get away from her. He ran to Beersheba, which is in Judah. Why is that significant? He left the country. Listen, I've been a chicken most of my life. And I've been in confrontation with people that scared me. And I've walked out of a room. I've left a building. I've even left town because I didn't want to deal with people. I have never fled to Mexico because I was scared of somebody. And that's exactly what he does. He goes to Mexico. He flees the country because he's afraid of Jezebel. And so God appears to him and God says, you've not gone far enough yet. I want you to go all the way. Look at verse 8. I want you to go. First of all, Elijah, I want you to get a little supper. Verse 8, get something to eat and drink. And then it says Elijah went in the strength of that food. So what does that mean? It means he did not eat again for how long? How many days does it say? 40 days. Does that ring a bell? Does that sound familiar? He doesn't eat for 40 days. And he goes to, notice where? To Horeb, the mountain of God. Horeb. Where is Horeb? Where is the mountain of God? What is another name for Horeb, the mountain of God? So Elijah now is on the mountain of God. God says to him in verse 9, what are you doing here? Why are you here? What does God's question mean? God's question means the battle is in Samaria. The need is in Samaria. You're all the way out here. What are you doing here? And Elijah said, I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. Now notice what he says here, because this is key to what happens. He says, and what? I alone am left. So in this nation of thousands of people, Elijah says what? I'm the only one. I'm it. There's nobody else. So God tells him in verse 11 to stand on the mountain. And the Lord was passing by. Does that sound familiar? Is there another time in the history, in the Old Testament history, when somebody was standing there and talking to God and God was passing by? Did that happen some other time? Did that occur? So God is passing by. And a great strong wind was rending the mountains and breaking in pieces the rocks before the Lord. Does that sound familiar? Was there another time on a mountain sometime that there was a storm and all that going on? Well, that's what's going on with Elijah. So there's this storm that's so powerful it's destroying rocks. But notice the Lord was not in the wind. So there's this windstorm. We know anything about that around here? There's this windstorm. God is not in it. And then there was an earthquake. But what? But God wasn't in it. And then in verse 12, there was a fire. But what? But God wasn't in that. Is there another time that somebody that was working for God stood on a mountain and there was a storm and an earthquake and a fire? Has that ever happened before? So Elijah's up there and all of this is happening. And God is not in any of it. But after the fire, what did he hear? Right? I think is the King James Version says a still small voice, or is that where we get that? The New American Standard says a gentle blowing. In other words, there was a quietness. There was a quietness and a soft sound. Right? And you know how that is when there's something really, 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 really loud, and then it stops and it's quiet. Right? You know how quiet that is. And so God has sent a windstorm, God sent an earthquake, God sent a fire, and God wasn't in any of that. And then God sends a very small, gentle sound. The implication is that's where God was. And so Elijah went out, and God confronts him again. Why are you here? The fight is there, and you're here. And Elijah says the same thing, I'm alone. I'm the only faithful one. And then God tells him in verse 15, go return. When you get back, he says, you're going to do three things. You're going to anoint a new king of Syria. You're going to anoint a new king of Israel. And you're going to anoint a new prophet to take over for you when you're gone. And, he says, you're going to learn something. You're going to learn that not only are you not alone, but what? There are 7,000 people who have not worshipped Baal. What's all the stuff with the wind and all that stuff? God is telling Elijah, you're looking because you've gotten used to these big spectacular things. You think if I'm not doing something spectacular that I'm not working, and that's not true. he says to Elijah, I've got two kings, a prophet, and 7,000 people in the chamber, and we're ready to go. And you don't know it because you're looking for something spectacular. The lesson there. But here we are with in 1 Kings 19 with Elijah and God on a mountain. Now, there's a lot of lessons here, and we could give a lot of life lessons from everything we just talked about. But that's not the point of this. That's not the point of 1 Kings 19. That's not the point of Elijah being on the mountain. The point of Elijah being on the mountain is that Elijah on the mountain, first of all, looks back to somebody else of importance who had already come before him. Elijah on that mountain is recalling another major Bible figure who's already come and gone. Do you have any idea who that is? Can you imagine who that might be based on what we've seen? But more than that, not only is Elijah on the mountain looking back to a major Bible figure, guess what else he's doing? And then Elijah and that person, guess what they're doing? They're looking forward to somebody even bigger. Who do you reckon that is? Who could that be? And so Elijah on that mountain, when we read this, there's a lot of life lessons. We could talk about all kinds. That's not the point. The point is that when we see Elijah on the mountain, there's somebody that's already come we're supposed to be thinking about, and there's somebody coming that we're supposed to be looking forward to. So let's talk about Elijah for just a minute. What do we know about Elijah? Just 10 things about him, many that we could talk about. He was an authoritative spokesman for God. When Elijah spoke, people had to listen or they got destroyed. He was authoritative. Elijah confronted an evil, stubborn ruler, right? Ahab and Jezebel, evil, stubborn people, and he stood toe-to-toe with them, at least initially. He defeated false gods. He went up on Mount Carmel and demonstrated that false gods are called false gods because they're what? False. That there is a true God. Elijah then fled from a ruler who wanted to kill him. He fasted for 40 days. We should kind of be seeing where this is going, right? This should be kind of ringing some bells at this point. All right, Elijah was part of God miraculously providing food. He met God at Mount Horeb. He complained about the Israelites and asked God to take his life. Somebody else did that. He experienced on the mountain the presence of God and the glory of God. And the end of his life ended in a miraculous fashion. So this is 10 random things about Elijah. There's somebody else in the Bible that all of those things are true of. Who is that person? Who else had every single one of those same experiences? Moses. Now, that picture, I really liked that picture when I chose it. Then I looked at it again. That's Moses parting the Red Sea while he's holding the Ten Commandments. And it looks like he's doing John Travolta from Saturday Night Fever. And so I don't like it quite as much as I did, but it's still a cool picture, so I'm going to go ahead and use it, but it's got some historical problems with it. But never mind about that. Moses, everything that I just told you about Elijah is also true of Moses, every single thing. When we're reading about Elijah, we are supposed to be thinking back about Moses. Elijah reminds us of Moses and everything that happened with Moses. That's important. But there's something that's more important than that. Who do you imagine that is that both Elijah and Moses are looking forward to? Who could be that person that was future to both Elijah and Moses that both of them were looking forward to? Who would that be? Well, if you said Jesus, you would be exactly right about that. It is Jesus. So turn over to Luke chapter 9 and notice in Luke chapter 9 something really interesting that brings all of this together. In Luke chapter 9, Luke chapter 9 is a passage that when you know the Old Testament, it can't help but ring some bells. In Luke chapter 9, notice in verse 1, first of all, we've got some miracles going on, like Moses and Elijah. In verse 7, we've got Herod the Tetrarch, an evil and stubborn ruler. We've got in verse 12 and following the miraculous provision of food, like Moses and Elijah. In verse 19, we've got Jesus saying, "Who do people say that I am?" And one of the suggestions was who? Elijah. We've got Elijah. And then, in verse 22, we've got the rulers who are opposing Jesus because of their wickedness. And so then we get to verse 28. In verse 28 it says, "Some days after these sayings, He took Peter and John and James," and what did He do? Where did He go? It says He went up on the mountain. Now this is not the mountain that Elijah and Moses were on. You figured out already, of course, that Mount Horeb and Mount Sinai are the same mountain. This is not the mountain that Jesus was on. That's way far away from where He is. But Jesus, like Moses and Elijah before Him, goes up on a mountain. And what does it say? It says in verse 29 that while He was praying, the appearance of His face became different. His clothing became white and gleaming. In other words, as Matthew tells us, He was transfigured. What does that mean? That means that His appearance was changed. It means that now on the Mount of Transfiguration, the true glory of Jesus as God is shining through. Can you imagine the sheer effort it must have taken to contain the glory of God in a physical human body for 33 years? The glory of God is contained in a physical body. How in the world could that body possibly contain the glory and majesty and light for 33 years? Eventually, it's just like a kid who's so excited about something and they hold it in as long as they can and they just can't hold it in anymore and they just let it go. And that's what Jesus does on the Mount of Transfiguration. He goes up on the mountain and He allows His glory to shine. He allows His majesty to be seen. He's transfigured on the mountain. And then, verse 30, "Behold, two men were talking with Him." Who was it? It was Moses and Elijah. Moses and Elijah appear talking to Jesus. In verse 31, it says, "They appeared with Him in glory, and they were speaking of His departure, which He was about to accomplish at Jerusalem." Can you imagine that conversation? Can you imagine that conversation? Jesus has been dealing with stubborn Israel for 3 years. He's been trying to straighten them out, and they don't want to listen. And eventually, stubborn Israel is going to crucify Him. Can you imagine that conversation when Moses and Elijah are talking to Jesus and going, "Man, I know exactly how you feel. I know exactly what you're dealing with. I had to put up with them too. And they haven't changed a bit." Moses said, "Since I had them in the wilderness." And Elijah said, "I had them under Ahab." And Jesus says, "I've had them for the last 3 years. They hadn't changed one bit. They're stubborn as they always were." And both Moses and Elijah faced death threats. Both Moses and Elijah, their lives were threatened. And can you imagine that conversation? Jesus saying, "I don't want to go through with this." And Moses and Elijah saying, "We know how you feel. We faced that. We know what that's like." And they're talking with Him about His departure, about His death, which would happen at Jerusalem. And they're comforting Him They're encouraging him. They're commiserating with him. But the main reason that Moses and Elijah are there, notice in verse 32, Peter and his companions had been overcome with sleep. When they were fully awake, can you imagine that? You go to sleep and you wake up and Jesus is transfigured and Moses and Elijah are there. When they were fully awake, they saw His glory and the two men standing with Him. As these were leaving Him, Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us make three," the New American Standard says tabernacles. Don't imagine He means a place of worship. He simply means a tent. That's all He means. "Let's make three shelters. One for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah." And you say, "Peter, you big dummy. What are you?" And you say that because you know the end of the story. You would have said the same thing. Because what do we say all the time about heaven? "When I get to heaven, I'm going to look up Moses. I'm going to go find his mansion. And I'm going to sit and listen to him talk about all of his experiences. And then when I get through Moses and Noah and Adam and Abraham and all the big shots, I'm going to work my way down to Elijah. I'm going to find Elijah's mansion. I'm going to go talk to him, listen to him talk." We do the same thing. We do the same thing. If Jesus and Moses and Elijah, we'd go, "Oh man, let's rent them apartments so they can stay. And we can hang out with them." And Peter, but it says Peter didn't realize what he was saying. While he was saying this, a cloud formed and began to overshadow them. Peter said, "Uh-oh, I've done it again." They were afraid as they entered the cloud. Then a voice came out of the cloud saying, what? The emphasis here is on the word "this." "This is my son. This is my son. Listen to him." And when the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone. And they kept silent and reported to no one in those days any of the things that they had seen. The purpose of Moses and Elijah showing up is so Moses and Elijah can leave. The purpose of Moses and Elijah showing up is so Moses and Elijah could leave. So that God could show it's about Jesus. Moses and Elijah were great in their time, but it's all about who? It's all about Jesus. Moses and Elijah were all about Jesus. How is that? What exactly does that mean? And what does it mean for you? I'm glad you asked. And I'll tell you. After I tell you that next Sunday morning, Lord willing, we're going to be talking about Jesus calming the storm in Matthew chapter 8, verses 23 to 27. If you want to read ahead, Matthew chapter 8, verses 23 to 27. And we're going to see what the main point of that is. The main point of that isn't Jesus can calm your storms. That's a nice thought. That's not the main point. We'll see what the main point of that account is when we get there, Lord willing, next week. So, what does all of this have to do with Jesus? You know, some of the things that Jesus did were exactly what Moses and Elijah did. Moses and Elijah confronted evil, stubborn rule. So did Jesus. So did Jesus. He did the same thing. Moses and Elijah fasted for 40 days. So did Jesus. Exactly the same thing. Moses and Elijah miraculously provided food. So did Jesus. He did the same thing. But there are some very significant differences between Moses and Elijah and Jesus. Moses and Elijah witnessed the glory of God. What about Jesus? Moses and Elijah witnessed the glory of God. Jesus was and is the glory of God. Jesus didn't see it. He was it. He was the glory of God. Moses and Elijah were authoritative spokesmen of God. What about Jesus? Jesus is the authoritative spokesman for God. Moses and Elijah saw God on a mountain. What about Jesus? Jesus was God. He manifested God on the mountain. Moses and Elijah ran. When the chips were down, Moses and Elijah ran from their confrontation with rulers because they did not want to die. What about Jesus? Jesus stood up to them and he went through all the way to death. And he did that because instead of complaining about Israel and having a death wish because he was tired of Israel, he died for Israel and for the world because he had to do that for us to be saved. Moses and Elijah had a miraculous end to their lives. So did Jesus. But Jesus was a resurrection from the dead. Moses and Elijah defeated false gods. Jesus, in his death and resurrection, defeated evil spirit beings. The application to us is this: Jesus is God. Jesus is God. If you are not a believer, you need to understand that Jesus is God. If you are a believer, you need to really be sure that you're committed to and locked into the idea that Jesus is God. We're going to talk about this, Lord willing, next Sunday night in Newport. We'll get more into that. But do you believe that? Do you believe that Jesus is God? Do you believe that Jesus is the ultimate divine spokesman? Do you believe that Jesus brought, like the Hebrew writer says, God long ago spoke to the fathers in many portions and many ways, but in these last days He has spoken to us in His Son. He is the ultimate divine spokesman. He loved and died for you. Moses and Elijah cut and ran when it came to facing rulers who wanted to kill them. Jesus did not. He stood there and he took it and he died for you. Jesus defeated Satan and eliminated the power of your sin, and the proof of it is in his resurrection. If you are not a believer, you need to think about it. If you are not a Christian, if you haven't committed yourself to serving him, you need to think about this. You need to think about what you believe here and what you've committed to here or haven't. What you need to do in order to be right with Him. You need to think carefully about what the Hebrew writer said. You can take out your songbook and turn to the invitation song if you haven't already. We'll sing that song in just a moment. But you and I need to think very carefully about what the Hebrew writer said. In thinking about the comparison between the Old Testament prophets like Moses and Elijah, in a comparison with Jesus, he said, we in these last days, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, he means the gospel, so that we do not drift away from it. Notice he's talking to believers. He's not talking to non-Christians. Now, if you're not a Christian this morning, you need to hear this too. You need to not just hear it, you need to act on it. But don't miss the fact that the Hebrew writer is talking to Christians. He says, so that we do not drift away from it. Notice that he's not picturing there some about face. He's not picturing there that you wake up one morning and you go, nah, not today. I was all in yesterday, but today, I'm just done with it. He's picturing a slow and gradual departure, isn't he? And that's really how it works, right? And you know this. If you've been there like I have experienced this. I've done this. I have had a slow, gradual departure, little by little by little, not realizing that what? When you wake up one day, you're way farther than where you were, right? If you go out to the beach and you get in the water on a boogie board or something like that, and you're floating around out there in the water, what's going to happen? You know what happened. What happened? If you walk straight out from where your family is on the beach, and you walk straight out, and you get in the water, and you kind of hang around out there and play around the water, in a few minutes you're going to look up, and what will have happened? You will have drifted down the beach. And now you're farther from where you were. And that's how it happens. To those who are believers, we don't wake up one day and quit. You know this. Maybe you've done it like I have. Maybe you've seen it. But it should be a warning to all of us so that we do not drift away from it. For if the word spoken through angels, he means there the Mosaic law. if the word spoken through angels proved unalterable. In other words, if you didn't like it, you couldn't just change it. If you found yourself doing something different, you couldn't just go in a referendum and vote to change it. Well, we want to do this now, so let's change it. It was unalterable. And every transgression and disobedience received a just penalty. If you broke the Mosaic law, what happened? They stoned you. If you went against Elijah when Elijah was at his best, if you went against Elijah, you starved to death or he killed you with a sword. If the word spoken through angels proved unalterable and every transgression and disobedience received a just penalty, how will we, those of us who know about Jesus, how will we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? He's arguing from the lesser to the greater there. He's saying, if the Mosaic law, which was a lesser system, so listen to what he's saying. If the Mosaic law, which was a lesser system, got you killed for disobeying it, then the system of Jesus, which is a greater system, gives out an even more severe punishment. And people mess this all up when they say, Jesus came and He just loosened everything up. Jesus came and made everything easier. Jesus came and under Jesus, now we don't have to worry about all that wrath and punishment and all that. We don't worry about that. That's not what He's saying. He's saying that if Moses brought a law that got you killed for disobeying it, and Jesus is greater than Moses, then the punishment for breaking His law is bigger than the one for breaking Moses' law. What He's trying to do is get our attention and say, if you need to fix something, you need to fix it. That's what He's trying to do. And so maybe that's had its effect on you this morning. You realize that there's something that you need to fix. If there is, we'd like to help you with that. Maybe you know what it is and you can just handle it. That's fine. But maybe you need help with it. You have questions or challenges or obstacles. You need some help with it. Well, we're here to do that, and we'd love to do that. If you have a spiritual need, if you're not where you need to be, and we can help with that, we hope that you'll let us know. We'd love to talk privately after church, or you can come forward and take a seat on the front as we stand and sing.